getting ready for the dreaded NPTE? How about winning a fully loaded NPTE home study bundle from ptfinalexam.com? Here's how to win. Follow us on Twitter at ptpinecast or enter online at ptpinecast.com. This is the PT Pinecast, a podcast that talks about physical therapy over beer. Bringing together clinicians, researchers, and forward-thinking PTs in a show that's anything but boring.
Let there be beer!
This is the PT Pinecast with your host, Jimmy McKay.
All right. Hi, welcome to the next edition of the PT Pinecast. Remember, sometimes the greatest conversations happen at happy hour. Welcome to ours. Just left a VPTA meeting with Seth Blee. He was the featured speaker. Graduated from Boston College's pre-med program with a Bachelor of Science in Philosophy. Then graduated with honors from Columbia University in the Big Apple. Master's degree in PT, and he completed his TDPT from Arizona School of Health Sciences. Works for Inova now in Virginia. I'm talking gate with Seth Blee. Seth, thanks for joining the PT Pinecast.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
So you just gave a talk at the a VPTA meeting. I know you had mentioned you'd done a bunch of talks, so that was real comfortable. That's essentially what we're looking for with the PT Pinecast. So people like you who understand these difficult concepts like gait, there's a lot of stuff moving around. Me as a PT student, a lot of stuff moving around. So thanks for sitting down and having a beer with us. So always my first question, what beer are we drinking?
This is a Blue Moon. Probably my favorite.
Love the Blue Moon, and my attempt through each episode is to have a different beer with each one so I don't get pigeonholed in anything. Going Sam Adams Cherry Wheat today, so cheers, and welcome to the PT
Pinecast. I'm a Sam Adams fan as well.
Yeah.
Is this going to get me some free Blue Moon sent to me?
I sure hope so. I'm looking for a beer sponsor. If there's anybody out there who wants to sponsor some college kids, we'll talk about your hooch. Gait's the thing you talk about. And myself as a PT student, I'm also a crazy, stupid runner, as you referred in your talk. I'll run through pain and stuff like that. It's definitely a topic that I want to know more about. We learn a lot about walking gait and what's normal. But man, when people run, all their parts are moving so fast. How do I figure that stuff out? So how did you start to specialize in gait?
Well, I would say I specialize in looking at function.
Okay.
You know, and gait is a big part of function. Whether you're talking about how people walk, how people run, how people do everything that they do. So the way that I started learning about a lot of this was through continuing ed courses. So I've taken a lot of my courses through the Institute of Physical Art. I've worked my way up through certifications and faculty member with them. And really everything that we do in the IPA is based on function. And it all really stems from a PNF background. PNF was the first class that we started teaching. All of the other courses really grew out of PNF. So PNF, I think, is amazing because it's, whether you're talking about orthopedic patients, neuro patients, anybody, we use PNF to treat function. It's how people move. It's efficient movement. So I got really into PNF and started training more and more in that of that, and then just realized that that just leads into gait observation and looking at how people
right.
move. So I think it was probably through my introduction to PNF and IPA coursework.
And I love the fact that it's IPA and that's also beer related.
Yeah, absolutely. We're trying to work on coming out with our own beer.
So you mentioned Con Ed courses.
Right.
I've heard from some people that have said students, first year out, just go treat. Or should we jump into those Con Ed courses if we think we want to specialize in something like gait?
I think regardless of what you want to specialize in, jump into courses day one. I run a residency program, and my new grads that come in take probably 5 to 6 courses their first year. I think, not a knock on PT school, it gives you the foundation, but a lot of times people walk out of PT school and they get into the clinic and they are just like a deer in the headlights. They don't even know where to start.
That was me this summer.
Yeah, that was me a long time ago. So I think you get a great background knowledge, but I think you need to get into courses right away.
So a lot of the people at the talk that you had just given were taking notes. One thing I took away from it, and I liked it because even someone like me can remember it. So we've got Stooges, Amigos, and Pillars of Gait, all things that goes in threes.
There you go.
So I thought that was great because you really set it up about the three components that can go and affect gait, the three pillars. And I really liked how you said these three pillars separate PT from other different kinds of practices. And it's not to talk about those practices, the other practices, in a negative way. Right. It's just to show what PT can offer. Can you talk about that just a little bit, those three pillars?
Sure. That's the IPA treatment model. All of our courses, we look at treating patients regardless of diagnoses in those three pillars. That when patients come in, whether it's an ortho patient, a neuro patient, whatever it is, we have to address those three main pillars. First is mechanical. Most PTs understand that people come in with restrictions in their body, dysfunctions in how they move, from their joints and soft tissues and myofascial tissues, all of those things that are dysfunctional. So we need to treat those, increase mobility through joint molds, soft tissue molds, and all that. So big part of PT, and I think manual therapy is a huge part of PT, but unfortunately a lot of therapists stop there. So then the next one we look at is neuromuscular, and that's the body's ability to initiate appropriate contractions, to get muscles to kick in, the right muscles to kick in when they should, and then to have efficient strength and endurance so that you can use the muscles appropriately. So that's another big part of what we do. And then third, which I think is missed in a lot of PT practices, is motor control. And that's how we move, how we function, how we use our bodies. So whether you're talking about gait training or lifting mechanics or sitting mechanics, all of that all falls under motor control. As I mentioned tonight, there's a lot of different practitioners that do little bits and pieces of that, but PTs are really the only ones that hit on all three. And I think I hear this from patients all the time. If they're not getting motor control training from the PTs, they're not getting. They can get strength training other places, they can get mechanical work other places, but I think that's, again, what separates PTs from everybody else, that ability to treat all three of those. I think that's what PT should be. Obviously, it's not what it always is, but I think that's what differentiates a good PT from a not so good PT also.
So we got mechanical, neuromuscular, and motor control. And I think that was something that I picked up tonight. Like I said, I don't write down notes, but if I remember that after the talk, if I can take one good thing away from a talk, I'm pretty happy. And that was one thing, because man, I went right back to my summer clinical in an outpatient ortho setting. And I remember just thinking, well, kneecap's not moving, it's Mobit. Did anything improve? No? Well, I got nothing else. So it's good to see that there's a different way to look at it. And I think the way you had presented those three things, very, very easy to digest, was a good way for you to remember there's those three big components. And like you said, not all practitioners can practice those three components, and that's where we get PT from.
So. Absolutely. I just took something away from it.
That's a good thing to learn. Yeah. In your practice, what are some big differences from Seth your first couple of years to Seth now? Is it a different approach, or have you just seen so many things?
It's a little bit of both. I've been a PT for 17 years now, and I should probably apologize to my patients for the first 10 years of it, because I really didn't know a whole lot about what I was doing. And I think some of that just comes from having, you know, that experience and that library of reference to refer back to. But a big part of it is just continuing ed. And I think the more courses I take, the more I learn, the more I can look and see things a little bit differently. So that's what I really try to share with my staff and my residents and my patients, really.
What do you see out of students that you're getting today versus a number of years ago? Any giant difference in the student?
You know, I think there's definitely more of a push on research, and they want to see proof of everything that we're doing. And that's good, because that's part of where the profession has moved. I think I've had students that it's kind of a negative, because they don't realize that evidence-based practice is part research, but part clinical experience
practice
as well. And some have come out and have said, well, show me a research article that proves that PNF works, for example, or that one component of gait is really what we say it is. So sometimes I think that's a bit of a challenge, but there's definitely a big push on the evidence now that didn't even exist when I came out of school.
What's a typical evaluation look like? One other thing I took from your talk was, if you're looking at someone's gait and they're standing there with their shoes on, then you're doing them a disservice. So you talked about looking from the top down. I mean, you went through the entire body. You went from shoulder and neck all the way down to feet. So where do you start? What's a typical gait analysis look like?
So frequently when someone comes in, regardless of what they come in for, I'm going to watch them walk. Not always on the eval, but at some point in their treatment, we'll usually record them walking so that I can sit down later and really analyze it. Normally when they come in for the eval, I look first big picture. What's jumping out at me? What are some key dysfunctions? You know, is it a foot alignment that just really looks like it's dysfunctional, driving a lot of other things? Is it a pelvis that's rotating and not moving like it should, or moving excessively? So I wouldn't say necessarily that I start in one area. First, I look at what jumps out at me. And then I probably do start, when I want to hone in on it, looking at what the pelvis and the trunk does, and then working my way down. but it's always shoes off. You can't see what the foot's doing with shoes on.
So we talk about shoes, and you had up some good graphics of the thongs. So it looks like the Jesus jumpers,
right?
And the Vibram Five Fingers, and then you go the other way. You got the Marshmallows. You got the Hokas. What are you running?
I'm running a standard running shoe. I think it goes with the idea of everything in moderation. You know, when people go overboard in one way or the other, I think eventually the pendulum swings and it kind of evens out in the middle. So I'm more of a standard running shoe guy.
You had mentioned how those fads, we go minimalist, we go maximalist, we go orthotics. You've seen the trends come and go. What's the next one? Because I'm going to write this down, and this is how I'm going to pay for
that's
for
a
grad
good question.
School.
What's I'd the be next a wealthy one man on? If I could tell you what that was going to be. You know, the extra cushion, the Hokas are pretty new. There hasn't been any real research coming out on those. What I've read initially shows that it doesn't really change a whole lot. So, I don't know, some biomechanical engineer in a lab is probably coming up with the next idea. I don't know, he's smarter than me. I haven't come up with it yet.
So in your intro before the presentation, it said that you've been a Division I athlete.
I was.
And I did some research. I couldn't figure out what sport it was. It's not listed anywhere.
I was a wrestler.
You're a wrestler. Okay, because you told us you don't consider yourself a runner.
No, and that's probably why I don't consider myself a runner. I ran a ton throughout my life to get in shape, to cut weight, to get ready to prepare for other sports. And I remember the last time that I made weight in college, I said, I'm never running again, and I'm never stepping on a scale again. But I picked it up over the years. I wound up getting a dog that was pretty high energy, so that kind of restarted my running career.
So going from a wrestler and never wanting to run again to cut weight, and you go to work every day and you watch people run and run and run and run and tell them how to run better.
Yep.
How do you get the patient to keep that motor control element before they go back to running? I mean, we talked about the mechanical, the neuromuscular. It's hard. I mean, like you had brought up in the presentation, core control is very important. But when someone's running, they're not thinking, I need to bring my belly button to my spine. This is real world. Different things happen. So how is that translation is the question that...
There's a couple of different parts of that question. So let me tell you, as far as the three components, motor control is always the goal, right? That's the end goal, is to train efficient movement patterns, teach people how to move efficiently. So I find that a lot of times when we start training the motor control, that's where you see the mechanical and the neuromuscular issues come up. And that's where it kind of leads me of telling me where to go. If I'm trying to train motor control and I see that this foot alignment isn't even allowing them to get in a certain position, then I need to go back and train the mechanic. Again, my goal is always motor control, but I have to step away from that at times to be able to treat the mechanical and the neuromuscular as well. As far as training it and making it automatic, this is a whole another continuing ed course that we teach, where we really look at when someone is in efficient alignment and has efficient mechanics, the body functions properly. If they're not in the right position, not in the right alignment, they don't use their body properly. So it's not just teaching them how to activate muscles, it's making sure that they're in the right position so that the body can work as it's designed. We're designed to work without thinking about it. And a lot of times that doesn't happen because people either shut off muscles because of an injury, or they are in a holding pattern, or not using their body efficiently, not in the right position. So we kind of lose that over the time with our injuries. So we always want to make sure that the body is in a good position, that we've trained appropriate initiation of the right muscles when they should work, train the strength, and then we work on motor control.
One of the questions during the presentation asking about using a mirror as a feedback mechanism, and you said you didn't really use that, but you used some apps. And I know students nowadays, man, they want some apps. What are some good ones that you use in the clinic that are pretty efficient?
You know, the one that I use the most, and I have it on my phone, I have it on my iPad, probably because it's a free one, so I like it. It used to be called UberSense. It's now called Technique or Huddle, and I use that all the time. I like it. There you go.
Got it on the iPhone right now. It's a great app.
I like it just because you can go slow motion, you can draw on it. You know, other things that I've used that for, I'm also a coach. I've coached baseball for many years, and I love recording kids' swings and kids' pitching motions. That's another passion of mine, is working with baseball players. And we can hone in and fine-tune mechanics of anything when you go in super slow motion. So that's probably the one that I use the most.
I used it this summer, my first outpatient ortho clinical rotation. I impressed my CI very few times this summer, but using that app, I actually got a nod and a squint out of her, which she was like, that's actually pretty cool. Can you show me how to use that? We can give an unsolicited plug to what was UberSense, which is now Huddle Technique. Super easy to use, doesn't take a long time, and it's instant feedback, and I liked it because instead of having to stare at themselves in the mirror, which I can barely chew gum and run, so watching me watch my feet, no good. I just said, do your thing, and I just kind of slipped it out of my pocket and had it down low and was recording. it would allow them to just do their thing and then watch either how ridiculous or how much better they had gotten. And again, you can draw on it. That's a pretty good app.
And it's free.
It's free. I want to keep that quiet because here's the thing. I talk about this enough, those guys are going to start charging for it. I don't want that.
This is the PT Pinecast, the NPTE, the big scary monster that waits for you at the end of PT school. To pass, just answer a question every 72 seconds for 5 hours on topics you've been covering over the last 3 years of PT school. Ugh, no pressure, right? Well, the PT Pinecast has your back. We've teamed up with PTFinalExam.com to get you through the test with ease. We're giving you a chance to win a PT Final Exam Home Study Bundle, loaded with a study guide book with over 200 pages of critical info, over 200 sample NPTE questions, over 25 hours of video lectures that cover the topics and practice questions, a recorded version of the popular Mastermind Study Groups, and a case full of beer. Oh, wait, there's no beer? Okay, never mind. This is how you pass the NPTE without losing any sleep. Here's how to win. Follow us on Twitter at PT Pinecast. Sign up to win online at PTPinecast.com and find us at the National Student Conclave in Omaha. We're giving away 3 PT Final Exam Home Study Bundles. Get yours now from PT Final Exam and the PT Pinecast. This is the PT Pinecast.
So as students, what's something we should pay attention to more and what's something we should pay attention to less in PT school?
As far as pay attention to more, and I alluded to this a little bit in our talk, I would say looking at the big picture a little bit more. I think a lot of times people can come into the clinic and therapists get very focused on, you know, all right, this is a patient after an ankle sprain. So the doctor's sending them for whatever treatment on their ankle and they forget that this is an ankle attached to a lot of other things. I think people get stuck in their tunnel vision and don't really look at how that ankle integrates with the rest of their leg and integrates with their trunk and works in a whole functional system. If you would have told me to look at that when I first came out of school, I would have been totally overwhelmed with
it's overwhelming, not able to do it.
But I think looking at the big picture and trying to step back a little bit, and something I challenge my staff with, that I always ask them almost every day I say this, well, what's driving that? You know, they come in and say, this person's got knee pain and I see a lot of, you know, lateral tracking of their patella. And I say, well, what's that coming from? And trying to find that driver is challenging when you first start seeing patients. But I think that's what I would really try to focus on, looking functionally at what's driving dysfunctions.
I liked what you had talked about with syndromes and that kind of anecdote that you had talked about when, if someone is talking about a syndrome, it typically means they really don't know what it is. It's just a kind of a hodgepodge, a collection of a bunch of things that kind of fit together. Where'd you pick that up?
You know, I don't know. I should probably credit whoever I heard say that a long time ago. Someone had said at a lecture I heard somewhere along the line that anytime you hear the word syndrome attached to something, it means they don't know. Whether that's IT band syndrome, patellofemoral syndrome, rotator cuff syndrome. It's a pretty common thing. Piriformis syndrome is a huge one. Somebody comes in with piriformis syndrome, I'm not just going right to that muscle.
Right.
I'm trying to figure out, well, why are they having pain in their butt? What's that coming from?
But I think that what you had brought up about that stuck out to me was, a bunch of smart people who have done this a lot of times before you, they still don't know. But remember that it's not just that. Just because it has the word IT band syndrome,
right,
it might not be the IT band. It might be something else.
Yeah, and the piriformis one is a huge one. We see that all the time. And, you know, going back to your question about what should PTs do less, I can't tell you how many years I've seen someone come in with piriformis syndrome and they get ultrasound rubbed on their piriformis and they get a little deep tissue work on their piriformis and are given a piriformis stretch without ever figuring out why are they having pain in their piriformis region. You know, I think that's, again, looking at more big picture and trying to figure out drivers of dysfunctions.
You had mentioned talking to patients in the clinic. I experienced this just a little bit in my outpatient ortho rotation. I told you my pain is at the knee, but you keep poking around at my hip. How do you explain to patients? What's like a good way to approach it? Because I think we get a lot of hands-on experience in class, but verbal communication is hard. How would you tell me as a patient, hey, my knee hurts, what are you doing up here at the hip?
Patient education is extremely important. I use a lot of anatomical models to show them. You know, one thing that we treat a lot, and this comes back to some of the IPA courses, we believe that one keystone structure that needs to be treated on so many patients is their coccyx. You know, and coccyx is where all the fascia anchors in the body at the coccyx, either your coccyx or your sphenoid bone in your cranium. So there's plenty of times where I might have somebody with a hamstring strain, with a knee pain, and I say, this is gonna sound crazy, hear me out. You have a lot of structures in your body that are interrelated. A lot of them anchor on your tailbone. So is it okay if I check a few things on your tailbone? 9 times out of 10, that's when somebody says, you know, I forgot to tell you, I did break my coccyx, you know, 10 years ago. And we hear that all the time. So I think educating patients as to how the body works together as a unit, showing them on models, putting it out there, like I said, saying, this may sound strange, but hear me out. And if they think that that's totally out of the area, then you have to pick and choose. Some patients I'm not going to go there with. But in most cases, I'll tell them, I can get rid of your knee pain, but I don't think that that's what's driving it. So unless we address why you're having your knee pain, odds are you're going to come back or you're going to have an issue somewhere else.
Yeah, you had talked about the anecdote with you had a female runner who had come in and she had already been through surgery, lateral releases, I believe, right, and a couple of knee surgeries. And you had taken her shoes off, and next thing you know, at her ankle, valgus. I said, did anybody ever take your shoes off and look at your ankle? No, they just keep cutting my knee open.
Right.
Well, I think we found something here, Watson. So situations like that, I'm sure, pop up a lot.
You know, and a lot of times, it's a tough situation, especially when we get somebody post-op, because as we're explaining things to the patient, a lot of times they'll say, I probably shouldn't have had that surgery, huh?
Yeah.
And I always say, that's not my place to say. You had it, so whether you should have or you shouldn't have, I'm not concerned about that right now. You had it. Let's work on addressing your mechanics right now.
So different topic. I didn't know this about you before you had spoken tonight, but you work with a residency.
Right.
And we had an earlier episode talking about residencies and fellowships. And when should students start looking at a residency and why? When do I begin to think about that and start looking for one? How does that process work?
I would say now.
Yeah.
Definitely now. I've had 5 residents now over the last several years, 2 that have completed it and have gone on for their functional manual therapy certification. And I have 3 that are currently in residency. And I think they all came in right out of school or shortly out of school, shortly after they graduated. So I think there's no better time than doing it right when you first get out. We've had some people apply and do residencies after several years, but I think why not go in and just start working on it right away?
Right.
And as far as why, you know, I go to a lot of job fairs for my company and I talk to a lot of students and a lot of new grads. And whether it's true or not, they all say the number one thing they want is mentorship. Yeah, they want money. They want loans repaid, but they want mentorship. If you're not doing a residency, if you happen to be in a place where you have a skilled clinician, you can get some mentorship, but the majority of the time that's not structured. So having a residency really gives you that structured one-on-one mentorship that I don't think you can get if you're not doing a residency.
Yeah, I see that that word mentorship thrown around a lot in a DPT student Facebook group. There's something like 18,000 students and it grows every day. And that is something that comes up a lot. I think a lot of these students are going into PT and they're not looking to be millionaires. I wouldn't say no to money, but you know, I'm not here to be a millionaire. I think a majority want to be really good PTs, and I think that's one thing that's reiterated throughout the profession is mentorship's the way to do it. Because as confident as I think some of my classmates are, I think some of them might be faking their confidence a little bit.
So Fake it till you make it.
And I think a lot of them are looking towards that and saying, I want to be in a good environment.
Absolutely.
And I think a residency, the more I ask this exact question, and we've been through, you know, a couple episodes here asking this question, that's the one thing I hear about the big advantage to a residency is that I can still be a student. I can still play the student card. And there's still someone there who's going to walk me through it instead of, well, I guess this patient is just going to kind of get substandard, subpar service.
Right.
I mean, none of us really want that. So I think that's a good explanation of why it's an advantage to get a residency. Who do you look to in PT? Anybody in particular?
I think not just in terms of gait, but my mentors over the years, again through the IPA, Greg Johnson and Vicky Saliba Johnson have just been amazing mentors to me. Now they're great friends as well, and I spend a good amount of time teaching with them and doing testing and certifications with them, and I just defer to them on all things PT.
Yeah.
I've had many times where I've had patients come in, and like I said, I've been doing this for a long time, and every once in a while I'll get a patient and I'll have to email them and I'll say, I just have no idea. You know, next time you're in the area, can you see this patient? I've taken a good friend of mine up to see Greg up in New York, and I said, I've treated him for a while and I've gotten to some point, but I'm missing something. So can you treat him? And I think having the two of them as mentors and really a lot of the senior faculty in the IPA have been great mentors to me. So I feel like I have to pay it forward and be a mentor to others.
I will give you a slight butt kiss moment.
Awesome.
I'm prefacing it. I'm not going to say who it was, but someone walking out of the talk that you had given earlier tonight and said, he was really cool, sounded like he knew his stuff, and didn't seem like a douchebag. And what I mean by that is somebody who's been doing it for as long as you have saying, you know, sometimes you just get those patients you don't know. I think that's comforting to students because, of course, we get a lot of those in the beginning of our career. And then we think that there's some magic moment. I don't know, 3 years, 5 years, 7 years, some moment I'm just going to be like, oh, yeah, I'm good. There's nothing I don't know. So send in anybody you want. I can take them. So hearing someone like you say, you know what, sometimes you just get something you don't know and you got to ask. You know, some people are going to look at the same patient and see something completely different.
Absolutely.
And that could be the answer.
Yeah, and I think, obviously, I mentioned Greg and Vicky as my mentors, but we do it a lot in my clinic also. You know, I've got a pretty wide range of experience levels, and one thing that we try to make a point to do, especially when someone's stuck with a patient, is they'll say, hey, I want you to schedule with somebody else. Just get a fresh set of eyes on them. Maybe I'm missing something. There's a lot of humility in that, and hopefully PTs can be comfortable knowing that they don't know everything, and sometimes you just need to get another therapist. Maybe they've been doing it half as long as you, but they may look at something totally different. And I've had patients that have gone and seen a new therapist, and then I look at what they were looking at, and I say, oh, yeah, I hadn't been doing that with them. That's a great call. You definitely have to be humble. You don't know everything. And I think the day that I think I know everything, I'm probably retiring.
That's good. When you're with a patient and you're frustrated that what the clinical pattern should be with an ankle sprain isn't there, some clinicians might get frustrated and just say, you know what? It's a gray area. And it's interesting that you work for the Institute of Physical Arts. It's an art. It's a science. Not all things are going to fit into neatly tucked away compartments. It's going to be a little bit of gray area. But how do you approach that when explaining it to a patient?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think that is why they called it the Institute of Physical Art, is it is an art. There's obviously great science behind what we do, but sometimes it's you have to be an artist. You have to kind of figure it out on the fly. You know, one of the things that we talk about in PNF is if somebody's not giving you the response that you want them to give you as far as a physical response, before you blame the patient, I always tell people when I teach this, blame yourself. Figure out what you're not doing wrong. Is it your body mechanics? Is it your manual contact, your cueing, whatever? And I think that you can even take that to other avenues of PT. If you're working with a patient and you're not getting the response that you think you should get, what can you do differently? How can you cue them differently? How can you come at that from a different perspective? You know, I think that's a huge thing that we need to do. And sometimes what we're missing is something that we would think is from way out in left field. I've had patients where I'm treating their lumbar spine and things just aren't getting better. And, you know, I find out they've got some visceral dysfunctions. And I've taken some visceral course, yeah. And I think, boy, once I go in and start mobilizing their guts and treating some things that seem like it's a little bit outside of the box, we start getting some different results.
Right.
It's not a set forward clinical pathway and clinical prediction. Sometimes it's, well, we just have to see what we're missing.
I think that goes back to your statement just a second ago with humility. You should blame yourself first. And by blame, I mean just question. Question
right.
yourself first. I'm not seeing what I thought I would see. Why? It's the why, not the what.
Yeah, I think that's extremely important. You know, I do patient rounds with all of my staff, and I've had therapists come to me and say, you know, their patient's coming for this and this, and this is what I've been doing, so I think I'm going to refer them back to the doctor. And I say, well, that's pretty much throwing in the towel and giving up. You know, have you looked at X, Y, and Z? What else can you look at? Maybe it's not something that's musculoskeletal, or maybe it's something outside of our scope.
Right.
But until you've exhausted all of your treatment options, I wouldn't just give up and say, well, I can't help you.
So on the PT Pinecast, our last section, it's brand new. So we have the pints. And before we're done, we do shots. So you have parting shots. So if there's a parting shot you can give to a few thousand DPT students, what would the Seth Blee of right now want to tell the Seth Blee of 17, 18 years ago to pay attention to as we head out into what our professors keep calling the real world? I'm not really sure what they're talking about, but apparently we have to go there after we graduate. What's a one good parting shot?
I think a lot of times therapists come out and they modify their treatment approach or their practice model based on where they work. And we all know that not all PT practices are the same. And I've taught to people all over the country and done a lot of teaching of manual therapy and everything like we're talking about, looking at the big picture. And people will say, well, I see 20-something patients a day. Or I get 15 minutes with my patient. And I just don't think you can work that way. And a lot of times people are driven by the wrong things. like you say, as PTs, we can be pretty comfortable in our lives. We're probably not going to be millionaires. But if you're really driven by seeing as many patients as you can and bringing in as much possible revenue as you can and paying off those ridiculous loans that you have, that's a challenge. And I think you can't give optimal treatment when productivity is your number one focus. You know, I run two clinics, so productivity is important. We need to keep the lights on, need to pay the bills. But if that's your number one goal, your treatment's going to suffer.
And that's why we're here. That's why we're taking on those giant, crazy loans. We had a conversation just about that. We were comparing kind of our outpatient experiences from this summer, and a classmate who I hadn't heard from her experience was kind of telling us how it went, and it didn't sound great. Sounded kind of like the bad version of what you were just alluding to, and I kind of thought, man, I don't want to work in that environment, and I hope I don't wind up working in an environment like that. So I think that's great parting shots right there with Seth Blee. Recorded live at the Yard House in Springfield, Virginia. I think this was a killer episode. I thank you for your time, my man.
Awesome.
Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for being on the PT Podcast. I hope this is not the last time we hear from you, my man.
Sounds good. Thanks a lot.
Like what you hear? Leave us a review on iTunes. It's not like our moms can keep giving us 5 stars every day. Or can they? The PT Podcast is intended for educational purposes only. No clinical decision-making should be based solely on one source. While care is taken to ensure accuracy, factual errors can be present. Our lawyers made us read that.